this media-drenched, data-rich, channel-surfing, computer-gaming age, we have lost the art of doing nothing, of shutting out the background noise and our thoughts. Boredom, the word itself hardly existed 150 years ago, is a modern invention. Remove all stimulation and we fidget, panic and look for something, anything to do to make use of the time. When did you last see someone just gazing out of the window on a train? Everyone is too busy working on the laptop, hammering into mobile phones. Instead of thinking deeply or letting an idea simmer in the back of the mind, our instinct now is to reach for the nearest soundbite. In modern warfare, correspondents in the field and pundits in the studio spew out instant analyses of events as they occur. Often, their insights turn out to be wrong. But that hardly matters nowadays. In the land of speed, the man with the instant response is king. With satellite feeds and 24-hour news channels, the electronic media is dominated by what one French sociologist dubbed le fast thinker, a person who can, without skipping a beat, summon up a glib answer to any question. In a way, we are all fast thinkers now.
From Carl Honoré's book In Praise of Slow, with music from Koyaanisqatsi Skatsi by Philip Glass. I know something about slow. In my teens and early 20s, I lived at the Finchton Manor community for young men whose lives had gone off the rails, run by the visionary educationalist George Lywood. Some 50 of us, plus 10 members of staff, led a deeply communal way of life in a battered Jacobean house and its extensive grounds. Chores, games, plays, dances, and cooking for the whole house every few weeks all played their part in a gradual surrender of our old ways of being and becoming part of something greater than ourselves. "How many Finchtons does it take to change a light bulb?" somebody once joked. The answer was, "Only one, but it takes a long time, and the light bulb has to really want to change." Mr. Lywood was born in the Victorian age, and today's high-speed society, with its fast food, Sunday trading, rapid transit, rolling news, and the all-pervasive internet, would have appalled him. Towards the end of his life, in 1972, he saw a billboard that proclaimed, "Access takes the waiting out of wanting," and shook his head sadly. "People today," he mused, "are always trying to buy things they don't want with money they haven't got." For him, the waiting and the wanting were inextricable parts of each other. Across the Atlantic, in that same year of 1972 at Stanford University, psychologist Walter Mischel was conducting his famous marshmallow experiment in deferred gratification.
Children aged 4 and 6 were led into a room, empty of distractions, where a treat of their choice, such as a marshmallow, was placed on a table. The children could eat the marshmallow, but if they waited 15 minutes before doing so, they would be rewarded with a second one. Some would cover their eyes with their hands or turn around so that they can't see the tray. Others start kicking the desk or tug on their pigtails or stroke the marshmallow as if it were a tiny stuffed animal, while a few would simply eat the marshmallow as soon as the researchers left. Only 1/3 were able to wait long enough to get the second marshmallow.
"I am waiting, I am waiting, all year, all year. I am waiting, I am waiting, oh yeah, oh yeah. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere."
The Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts once observed that his career had consisted to date of 5 years playing and 25 years waiting around.
You can't hold out, you can't hold out, oh yeah, oh yeah.
A follow-up study, 20 years after the marshmallow experiment, showed that the ability to delay gratification correlated with higher test scores at college age. Patience, says the writer John Burroughs in Leaf and Tendril, is essential to a contented life.
I have had, I say, a happy life. When I was a young man, 25, I wrote a little poem called Waiting, the burden of which is, my own shall come to me. Those who are born to strife and contention find strife and contention ready at their hand. Those who are born for gentleness and love find gentleness and love drawn to them. The naturally suspicious and distrustful find the world in conspiracy against them. The unkind, the hard-hearted, see themselves in their fellows about them. The tone in which we speak to the world speaks to us. Give your best, and you will get the best in return. We all get our due sooner or later, in one form or another. All the best things of my life have come to me unsought, but I hope not unearned. That would contradict the principle of equity I've been illustrating. A man does not, in the long run, get wages he has not earned. There is no shortcut. For anything worth having, one must pay the price. And the price is always work, patience, love, self-sacrifice. No paper currency, no promises to pay, but the gold of real service. Waiting, with me, has been mainly a cheerful acquiescence in the order of the universe as I found it, a faith in the essential veracity of things. I have waited for the sun to rise and for the seasons to come. I have waited for a chance to put in my oar. Waiting for someone else to do your work, for what you have not earned to come to you, is murder time. Waiting for something to turn up is equally poor policy, unless you have already set the currents going that will cause a particular something to turn up. The farmer waits for his harvest after he has sown the seed. The sailor waits for a breeze after he has spread his sail. Much of life is taken up in waiting, fruitful waiting.
But still somehow thrive.
The elephant, the huge old beast, is slow to mate. He finds a female, they show no haste. They wait. For the sympathy in their vast shy hearts, slowly, slowly to rouse, as they loiter along the riverbeds and drink and browse, and dash in panic through the break of forest with the herd, and sleep in massive silence, and wake together without a word. So slowly the great hot elephant hearts grow full of desire, and the great beasts mate in secret at last, hiding their fire. Oldest they are, and the wisest of beasts, so they know at last how to wait for the loneliest of feasts, for the full repast. They do not snatch, they do not tear. Their massive blood moves as the moon tides, near, more near, till they touch in flood.
The lessons of patience, as extolled by K.D. Lang in Still Thrives This Love, and D.H. Lawrence in his poem The Elephant is Slow to Mate. Elephants, of course, with a life expectancy of 70 to 80 years, can afford to take their time in a way that 17th century English poets could not. And Andrew Marvell was a young man in a hurry.
Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges' side shouldst rubies find, I by the tide of Humber would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run.
In the event, Andrew Marvell actually lived for 57 years, which, considering they included the English Civil War and its subsequent turmoil, was not a bad innings for the time. Whether his coy mistress eventually succumbed is, alas, not recorded. In the modern age, says Milan Kundera, we've become so adept at making the sun run and devouring our time that speed itself has become an addiction.
I am driving, and in the rearview mirror I notice a car behind me. The small left light is blinking, and the whole car emits waves of importance. The driver is watching for the moment the way a hawk watches for a sparrow. Speed is the form of ecstasy the technical revolution has bestowed on man. As opposed to a motorcyclist, the runner is always present in his body, forever required to think about his blisters, his exhaustion. When he runs, he feels his weight, his age, more conscious than ever of himself and of his time of life. This all changes when man delegates the faculty of speed to a machine. From then on, his own body is outside the process, and he gives over to a speed that is non-corporeal, non-material, pure speed, speed itself, ecstasy speed. Why has the pleasure of slowness disappeared? Ah, where have they gone, the amblers of yesteryear? Where have they gone, those loafing heroes of folk song, those vagabonds who roam from one mill to another and bed down under the stars? Have they vanished along with footpaths, with grasslands and clearings, with nature? There is a Czech proverb that describes their easy indolence by a metaphor. They are gazing at God's windows. A person gazing at God's windows is not bored. He's happy. In our world, indolence has turned into having nothing to do, which is a completely different thing. A person with nothing to do is frustrated, bored, is constantly searching for the activity he lacks.
From the album On Land, part of Brian Eno's Ambient series, conceived while he was laid up in bed after a road accident, bored out of his mind. The precocious Bertrand Russell was so bored at the age of five that the lifetime lying ahead of him seemed unendurable. Like myself, he frequently contemplated suicide in his teens and was saved not by a therapeutic community, but by his love of mathematics. His love of life also increased year by year, largely, he observed, due to a diminishing preoccupation with himself.
One of the essentials of boredom consists in the contrast between present circumstances and some other more agreeable circumstances. It is also one of the essentials of boredom that one's faculties must not be fully occupied. Running away from enemies is, I imagine, unpleasant, but certainly not boring. A man would not feel bored while he was being executed. Boredom is essentially a thwarted desire for events, not necessarily pleasant ones. Wars, pogroms, and persecutions have all been part of the flight from boredom. Even quarrels with neighbours have been found better than nothing. Boredom is therefore a vital problem for the moralist, since at least half the sins of mankind are caused by the fear of it. I am waiting for the second coming, and I am waiting for a religious revival to sweep through the state of Arizona, and I am waiting for the grapes of wrath to be stored. And I am waiting for them to prove that God is really American. And I am waiting to see God on television, piped onto church altars, if only they can find the right channel to tune in on. And I am waiting for the Last Supper to be served again, with a strange new appetizer. And I am perpetually awaiting a rebirth of wonder. I am waiting for my number to be called, and I am waiting for the Salvation Army to take over, and I am waiting for the meek to be blessed and inherit the earth without taxes. And I am waiting for forests and animals to reclaim the earth as theirs. And I am waiting for a way to be devised to destroy all nationalisms without killing anybody. And I am waiting for linnets and planets to fall like rain. And I am waiting for lovers and weepers to lie down together again in a new rebirth of wonder. I am waiting for the Great Divide to be crossed, and I am anxiously waiting for the secret of eternal life to be discovered by an obscure general practitioner. And I am waiting for the storms of life to be over, and I am waiting to set sail for happiness. And I am waiting for a reconstructed Mayflower to reach America with its picture story and TV rights sold in advance to the natives. And I am waiting for the lost music to sound again in the lost continent, in a new rebirth of wonder.
Can you feel the rain just falling down?
From A Coney Island of the Mind by Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Can you feel the rain just falling down? Can you feel the rain just falling down? Can you feel rain? Let a rain just falling down. Can you feel the rain just falling down? Falling down. Falling down.
It's been hard to make sense of the sudden violent destruction that's erupted in our streets this summer. Amid the storm of analysis, opinions and proposals that's followed, the one story that stayed with me was a simple tale of redemption by a former gang member called Gavin McKenna on Sky News. While on probation, a friend persuaded him to come to church.
The pastor spoke on the word about positive voices and negative voices in our life, and I kind of cried a bit because I realised at that moment, at 19 years old, all I've ever had is negative. And the pastor placed his hand on my shoulder and said, no, there's a hope here for you. And I just broke down. I started crying like a baby. I said, look, I don't want to go back to that life. You're promising me that things will change. Can you help me? And I thank God a year and a half down the line, I'm still here now. That's all it was. And that I could be somebody.
In the same news report, youth leader Sheldon Thomas from Target Against Gangs was appalled but not surprised by the violence. His prayers, he said, went out to its victims, but also, more controversially, to its perpetrators. We've got to look behind why some of these 10, 11 and 12-year-old young men are involved in criminal activity, he urged. We look behind the anger, the facade, the knife, the guns, the drugs, and see that these young people are still vulnerable children. I'll be honest. Some of my best friends at Finchdon Manor had burgled, terrorised or even set fire to their neighbourhoods before encountering George Lywood. Had we been born 40 years later, a good many of us would certainly have been out looting city streets this summer. Mr. Lywood's slow and patient approach to rehabilitation couldn't have been more different from the swift retribution that press and politicians currently baying for. Yet, it achieved more than double the success rate of Borstal's and approved schools in its day. Hard times lie ahead, and nothing justifies violence or criminality. But if we actually want to make it stop, then we'll need to address the emotional as well as the economic deprivation at its root. And that will take time. Mr. Lywood's favourite poem was Learning to Wait by Richard Church.
Learning to wait consumes my life, consumes and feeds as well. Where I have loved, I love in strife. That love I could not tell. I saw it vanish into hate because I had not learned to wait. This I declare because I know that where I love again, I shall not ask the seed to grow, nor grind unripened grain, but silent in my blissful state, serve love through having learned to wait. All that I grasped at, I have lost. All I relinquished, won. The marriage of two minds at most deceives till all is done, and love, the conqueror, yields to fate, strong in having learned to wait.